This is Synaptic. Welcome. You have found our podcast that looks at the people, the research, and the challenges of the neuroscience space. This is episode 19 of Synaptic. My name is Brady Huggett, and I host the show. Just hold on one second. Okay, for today's episode, let's go back to 1826, and let's go to the General Hospital Society of Connecticut, which was founded that year in New Haven as a charity. The hospital was meant to provide healthcare to the poor, and the facility had just 13 beds when it opened, and it cost $13,000 to build back in the 1800s. Now, eventually, the hospital expanded to serve the public more generally, and it began treating sailors coming off the ships docked in New Haven Harbor. During the Civil War, some 25,000 U.S. Army soldiers were brought to the hospital for treatment. And eventually, in 1965, after forming an official agreement with Yale, the facility took on the name Yale New Haven Hospital. Now, today it has more than 1,500 beds. It's a nonprofit hospital with a range of specialty services, and it is the primary teaching hospital for Yale School of Medicine. And it is here, around 2001, that Damien Fair took a job after finishing his Master of Medical Science degree in the Physician Associate Program at Yale. So that is our guest for today, Damien Fair. Already, at the point of taking the job, Damien knew he was probably not going to be a clinician, he said. But he wasn't sure what was next. He took a PA position with Stephen Waxman, chair of the neurology department then, and Larry Brass, a neurologist at Yale School of Medicine and an expert on stroke. Working with those two men, Fair was exposed to a lot of basic science research, he said in this episode. And he also came in contact with non-invasive imaging experiments with functional MRI. His mind was blown by that, he said, how he was able to look inside someone's brain and see how things were working without opening the skull. And from that point on, Fair knew that doing research and understanding the brain was what he wanted to do. We talked about that on this podcast. We also talked about basketball being his first passion, and how it felt to relocate to Minneapolis not long after George Floyd was killed by police in that very city. And of course, we talked about mapping the brain's functional neuroanatomy and how that relates to mental health. All of it, fascinating stuff, that's coming up in the next hour. I recorded Damien on November 12th, 2024, at the Masonic Institute for the Developing Brain in Minneapolis, the last interview I did in 2024. It was windy and cold that day, the temperature around freezing in the morning. I met Damien in the Institute's video and audio studio, and I set up mics across the table, and we settled in. So that should be enough to set you up for this. Here is your episode of Synaptic with Damien Fair, starting right now. Well, listen, first off, thanks for making the time.
Yeah, I
really appreciate it. So my first thing that I want to talk about, you actually are from here.
Yeah. I'm from Minnesota, yeah.
By birth?
No, I'm actually originally from Miami, Florida. But then my mother is originally from Minnesota, and uh-huh. I moved back here when I was very young, 2 or 3 years old. And then, so I grew up here, so this is home.
Yeah, so you grew up here.
Originally from Miami, yeah.
So your mother is from here.
Yeah, she's from Worthington, Minnesota, actually.
So how did your family start in Florida?
Well, she actually lived down there at the time and then moved back after she had me.
Uh-huh.
So she moved you know, down there, you know, for a relationship and work and things like that, and was there for a while and then eventually came back.
Okay, so do you know how your parents met?
Well, yeah. So my I don't really know my biological father, but my stepfather, they met when I was really young, about the same, not too much after we moved back, probably like 4 years old or so, in Worthington. He's a musician at the time and was traveling around in this band and was in town, and they met, and you know, so, and then they eventually got together. He got his computer science degree and ended up working for IBM after he kind of gave up the road show. And then
I'm not going to know this band, am I?
No. Well, no. They had a couple of big like openings like way back when, but this is way back. You probably won't know them. They're called Sun Touch.
Sun Touch.
Yeah.
No.
Anyway,
No, like Sunvolt. I remember that kind of band.
Yeah, yeah.
Was this like, what kind of band was this?
It was like, you know, it was, they had a
well, what did rock. He play? Maybe that's a
he
question.
Played guitar. So he guitar and vocals, but mostly the lead guitar and lead of the band. Yeah.
Huh. Okay, yeah. So he was. They came through, did a show in Minneapolis.
In Worthington.
In Worthington. Okay.
So they did. They'd done a bunch of shows in Minneapolis, Chicago, but they were traveling everywhere. You know, these. You know, they're kind of artists all over the place. You know.
Your mom knew the band, or just happened to be at the show.
Just happened to be at the show, actually, and her sister at the time dragged her out. You know, and they met
and he left the band, came here.
Yeah, exactly.
Not to Minneapolis, but came to Worthington or whatever. Yeah.
Well, not Worthington. By the time he quit the band, when they kind of broke up or whatever, we were in Winona, Minnesota at the time, and so, but then he moved there and he was a history. He's running there, but he's a history. He had a master's in history of all things, but of course. It's almost worse than being in a band as far as like money.
Money. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So he went back to school, first doing electrical engineering as a vocational, just to kind of for work, and then also computer science. And my mother's a court reporter, actually worked in Wabasha County, home of grumpy old men.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right.
And then, you know, when he got done with his degree, he got, you know, it kind of really kicked off their career because he got a job at IBM in Rochester. The home of IBM was in Rochester, Minnesota at the time. He would commute to Rochester, yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's, you consider that your father, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah. And your mother's a court reporter. She did that the rest of her career.
She did. They retired, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. At the time, we were living in Oregon. This is before my commute back to Minnesota.
Right, yeah.
After they retired, they sold the house and moved out to Oregon to be around grandkids and live out there for a while. And then we moved back with us. So now they're in the Twin Cities now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you're growing up with this father who's musically talented. He's also a computer scientist. Your mom's a court reporter. I mean, I think that you had an interest in science because I know where you went to high school.
Yeah.
Did you have an interest early on that you knew of?
I did. I say yes or no. So a lot of people don't know this. I wasn't always like the best student, you know. In fact, I was okay, but I was not, you know, I was a goofball and get in trouble and all that kind of stuff for a long time. The only thing I was really good at was math. Huh. You know, I was always good at math, you know. But, you know, because I was a little bit of a recluse and stuff when I was younger, I had to actually on purpose stay in the lower math courses and classes so I could be with my buddies.
I know that feeling. Yeah.
But I was good at math and I was very interested in, even way back in like the fourth grade, in the brain. For whatever reason, I was like, I want to be a neurosurgeon.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know why. It's just like there's like, I was very curious about the brain and neurons. And because I wasn't such a good student, I remember actually that the teacher at the time laughed at me, like when I said it, you know?
You're going to be a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, I was going to be like in the classes, you start laughing, you know? Yeah. I remember this very specifically, that, you know, and she's like, well, do you even know what a neurosurgeon does? And I really didn't, but I knew they had like, I knew they dealt with neurons and
the brain.
And for whatever reason that interests me. But then, you know, it's funny. And then of course you go through this entire life course, right? And eventually it kind of came back to that, you know, I was just, it's kind of been fascinating. It's always been there. I mean, I didn't, in college, I was biology and chemistry. Mm. I was pre-med, you know, it was a natural thing to do.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, probably my spark in the sciences at all, and probably what really propelled me was at the time at my high school, when I got, oh.
So this is the Minnesota Academy of Math and Sciences, or for Math and Sciences, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how, but that, I don't know how that works, but is that, you have to aim for that? You want to go to a school that is focused on the math and sciences?
Or no, that wasn't that at all, actually. So my high school was Cotter High School. It was it's a you know, small private Catholic school in Winona, which my mother, who was very, education was very important to her. And she, you know, she grew up in this Catholic family and Catholic schools. And when we got to Winona, she's like, you're going to, didn't have a, I don't even know how she afforded it or anything. I don't think she probably had to pay. But the, but was putting me into this Catholic school system. And I was kind of, you know, did great. It was a really good experience. And then, but when I really turned my academic mind around when I got to high school and essentially just started trying and getting curious about stuff, and the sciences really, really picked up for me. There's the Hiawatha Foundation, there's a group there that's led by, that was led by Bob Kierlin and a few other philanthropists who really support the school system and actually the entire region.
Yeah.
They had a vision to start this new Academy of Math and Science that was connected with my high school.
Okay. All right.
And so I was actually the first class.
Okay.
And so we, which was probably lucky because I probably wouldn't have been able to get in if I wasn't first.
Huh.
But we, you know, it was an application process and we got in. But then we were just exposed to all this. It was a huge investment at the time. And we were just exposed to all this new technology, things that, you know, you get lucky to do if you were in college. At the time, PCA or like how to like code DNA was just coming online. And we were doing that as high school students and it was wild, you know. And so then, you know, and not only that, but we got college credit. This is before like the you know proliferation of like AP classes,
right,
and all this stuff.
Right.
So we got college credit, and we we did work with the with some of the local colleges. It's a college town. I mean, just we had a huge experience, and that when I so then when I got in when I actually went into college and went into like I said biology and chemistry, I was like, as you know, as advanced, as kind of far ahead, and it just made
prepared.
It easier, super prepared. It made it really easy to make it through. I was a basketball player, but the reason why I ended up at Augustana College in South Dakota was because of basketball, for sure.
Oh, I didn't know that. Did you play there?
Yeah, I played there. I got a scholarship to play there, and my parents said, "Well, looks like we found your spot."
Yeah.
You know.
So I want to go back to one thing. So
yeah.
In fourth grade, you say you want to be a neurosurgeon, and the teacher laughs at you because, I mean, frankly, like, who in fourth grade actually says that or maybe even knows what that is, right? But you said you remember that.
Well, I mean, I don't think I was thinking – I mean, I wasn't really thinking at all when I was that – I do remember being, like, nervous that I didn't know the answer, you know, to the question, you know. It's more when I look back and I remember the moment and I'm like, because it stuck, even though I wasn't offended or anything at the time. But I remember like why is anybody laughing at that, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, and it kind of it's somewhat vindicated, you know,
it worked out.
It kind of works out, yeah. And it's, you know.
But so you said you were like not doing well in school because it sounds like you weren't interested. Obviously, the intelligence is there. It was like you weren't interested. But when you got to this high school, there were so many new things that you couldn't help but be interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a couple of things that probably changed. One is the environment at the high school for just like the academy was different and unique, and the people were motivated, the teachers were motivated, and it's just like this, the vibe was different. Number one, but number two, probably, and maybe it was most important, is that my peers in the cohort that I started becoming close with at that time they're all go-getters. You know,
yeah.
They're all just, even now, they're just, everybody's out in the world, like, doing crazy, amazing things. And it's just kind of that peer influence probably was a big shot, too. Plus, I'm a competitive guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm hanging around with people and they're doing better or something, it's like, I'm not going to allow that, you know.
Yeah.
So there's probably a bunch of the environments, you know, my peers, and then just having access to things that normal
super
kids
interesting
don't,
things
yeah,
like
don't
DNA.
Have access to.
Yeah.
That it just kind of like hit a spark in me. And then, you know, all throughout high school, I became one of the better students in school, you know, even though before then.
You were not.
I was not.
But you also must have been one of the better basketball players in the school.
Yes.
Yeah. So how tall are you?
I'm 6'3".
6'3".
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm assuming you also were playing basketball all the time growing up. This was like a big passion of yours.
Yeah. That was probably number one.
Your number one passion.
For sure. Yeah.
So when you get out of high school, I mean, did you have dreams of playing in the NBA? Was that sort of like in the back of your mind?
Yes and no. I mean, I traveled around with folks from the select team here in Minnesota around the country and with the AAU teams. Yeah. It wasn't as big as it is today.
Yeah.
And probably at that time I kind of did, but then, you know, as I went through the process and everything, I was slowly kind of fading a little bit. So I would say by the time I was done with college, I was done. You know, I had a lot of friends who went overseas and played and continued on the journey. But for me, you know, I had ambitions to go back to school.
Yeah,
I mean, I just was on a different, my headspace was different.
Okay, so you go to college, you study in your major's biology, I think your minor's chemistry or something like that.
Yep.
You're playing basketball for 4 years.
Yep.
Yeah. And so when that ends, I don't know, you're probably like, well, I'm not going to the NBA, but anyway, I've got this other stuff I'm really good at. And you were thinking about medicine. This is like the neurosurgeon came back around? The idea.
Yeah, well, I was pre-med. I mean, I was biology, chemistry, but pre-med. And really, I mean, I was just going, I was playing basketball. I mean, I would say my, you know, my headspace now where I am as a professor and stuff, even in college, probably wasn't really there. I mean, I was good at school and I could do it, but I wasn't all in. Like now I'm looking at these kids in undergrad who come and work in my lab and stuff, and they're just like, just blowing me away.
They're all in.
At their skill sets, their maturity and all that. You know, I wasn't even remotely close at that age. But, you know, I was on a path, you know, I was just kind of doing what people told you, what you're supposed to do. You know, I'm pre-med, I get the grades, and then you apply, and you just kind of go down the road. But then I did a few things. One is I did a bunch of shadowing, and I even shadowed a resident who was not, they were not very happy, you know, and during residency, during training, you know, so you shadow and you do stuff with the physician who's like, well, established and been there for a long time. And they're always like, this is the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
You go to someone who's in training for 4 to 8 years of residency, like during that period, and it's not so fun.
So what were the complaints? It's just, I work too much.
Yeah.
What kind of doctor was he?
Probably orthopedics, I think. I don't even remember, to be honest.
Huh.
But I was into orthopedics at the time, partly because of the
sports.
Yeah. But I don't remember. But what I do remember is that I just knew that, boy, I better be damn sure this is what I want to do, because you're kind of locked in, you know, once you make the leap, you know?
Yeah.
So I decided to hold off, and when I got from one of my friends who was actually at school, was looking into this physician assistant or physician associate programs, and which are trained like medical models. It's only 2 years. It's a good profession. And I said, you know what, maybe I should just do that for a couple of years. And if I like it, I can still go back to medical school. Mm. If I think that this is enough, I still have it's a great profession. If I want to do something else, it's only 2 years. I can do something else too, you know? So instead of going to medical school, I applied to the physician, so I took a year and then applied to these physician assistant programs, was accepted into Yale University, and then went there for a couple of years.
So when you apply for, I mean, that's a great school. So you're setting your bar this high. Did you apply to Harvard? Did you apply to, I don't know, Stanford, those kinds of schools for this?
No, I didn't. I applied, where did I apply? I don't remember why I applied to Yale. It was one of a few, but I applied to like Mayo. I applied to schools in Iowa. You know, I'm a Midwestern kid, So, in a few other places, but I didn't apply to like any other places on the East Coast that I remember. I do not remember what the impetus of was me applying there, but it must have been something that someone told me that I liked.
Yeah,
and so I applied and got in, and you know.
And then left the Midwest then.
And I left the Midwest for the first time, which was a trip, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we should say your school, your college was Sioux Falls, right? That's in South Dakota. So you had been really, that's not far from here. So you've been kind of in this area.
Yeah.
So when you get to Yale, did you feel overwhelmed at all? Meaning like you've come from the Midwest and here you are at Yale and it's got like the best people over the world, or I don't know.
I was very nervous when I started. I felt very much like an imposter. I mean, right when I got kicked, I mean, there were so many ridiculous stories that are, when looking back, they're hilarious now. I mean, but so naive, and, you know, I, you know, look, I mean, when I left South Dakota, and of course I didn't have any money, right? So, yeah. But I left South Dakota. I had like a basement. I was living in this basement of this large house. I had my own bathroom, my own bedroom, my own living room, and I paid $100 a month for rent. Right. So I'm looking at, and I can't go out the East Coast to look at places. I don't have money to do that.
Right.
So I'm just doing everything sight unseen on the internet.
Yeah.
And I'm finding places like $400, $500. I'm like, oh man, these places are going to be amazing. You know,
it's going to be an entire house.
This is going to be awesome. You know, so I find a place out there, and of course. And I have to sign the lease sight unseen and everything. Yeah. And then I get out there and it's a complete disaster, you know. Like my first place was just a nightmare, you know, on Orange Street in the Greg Ghetto out there. So anyway, I was when I
did you leave that place or did you
eventually after a year, but I'm in there for a year. You know?
Yeah. And so you're trying to study?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So but it's fine. I mean I was a kid, you know, so everything is fine. But no, I felt like very much like, I mean, it was a new culture, new environment. And then B is that now I can teach my kids that they shouldn't feel this way, but you're kind of walking into this place which has this storied history and this societal, you know, like perception.
Yeah.
So I'm just sitting there looking around my class, and I remember this very specifically, like, oh my God, I'm dead. Like I'm gonna get killed at this place, you know? But of course, maybe within a week or, you know, a very short period of time, as you get to know people, get their background, you talk a little bit, you see what, you know, you realize, oh, you know.
They're just people.
They're just the same. And it's like, it's all good, you know. So, and then, I did fine, you know, and it was great. I got a job at, I knew right away when I finished that I was probably not going to be a clinician. It was not my bailiwick, even though, you know, I did fine in school and everything. But I got a job at Yale New Haven Hospital. In the neurology department, Steve Waxman was the chair at the time, and this guy who's now passed away, his name is Larry Brass, was a really famous stroke, cerebrovascular disease neurologist who was looking for a PA to help them with his research, but also help with his practice on the wards and in clinic. And my brain went back to the research element, and so I talked to Steve and, you know, Larry about getting this position, that I'd be a good position, even I had no experience, and they agreed, and they brought me on and really exposed me to a lot of basic science research. I worked with Bennett Shaywitz and some of the residents on some initial imaging experiments, you know. Yeah, I was still practicing as a clinician, but I was doing this kind of bit on the side with some of the, like, almost like a resident.
Yeah.
And then my mind was blown at the idea at some of these, you know, non-invasive imaging experiments with functional MRI where I could look inside people's brains and see how they were working without actually even touching it.
So you were doing it almost like a clinician, like we're trying to diagnose something, but then you realize that you could just try to figure out the brain in general.
Well, we weren't using fMRI in clinical practice, but we were, me and some of the residents were designing experiments to help answer questions related to clinical phenomena in neurology, particularly around stroke.
Yeah.
And so we were just designing experiments to do with this, you know, like at the coffee shops and stuff. Of course, they were terrible, terrible experiments. Oh my God. But we had, you know, we had some mentors there and some folks that really allowed us to explore, even though they probably knew it was, these are terrible experiments. Yeah. They never worked. They didn't make it anywhere, but it did really light the spark and said, okay, this is this thing. The doing this research and understanding the brain is what I want to do.
Okay. So there's a couple things that I think that also happen here. One is you meet your wife, Rahel, right?
Yes.
At Yale somehow. So she's in the medical track?
Yeah. So you're asking, it's funny, you know a lot about my history, but it's funny. Yeah. So, and I'm leaning into all these funny stories. So my first year in school, all the PAs and the medical students, the first year medical students, they do all the neuroanatomy.
Yeah.
Or not neuro, the anatomy course together. Yeah. And so we were in the same course doing a lot of, learning around anatomy, neuroanatomy, cadavers, you know, the whole nine yards for school.
Yeah.
But we also realized during that time that she has family back in Minnesota. She's originally from Ethiopia, but a huge chunk of her family, brothers, cousins, aunts, uncles, they live here in Minnesota. And so she travels back to Minnesota for the holidays. So we learned that we were both going to be coming back to Minnesota for the holidays. And so we hung out. First time we ever hung out was actually here in Minnesota, even though we were both met at Yale. There's even a funny story where
it's like a rom-com.
We kind of hit it off. And there's even a funny story where we had separate flights and stuff, even going back to New Haven.
Yeah.
But her flight got canceled. And so I remember sitting there with I'm still like in basketball gear like back in those days. So like I got my hat on, the long shorts and baggy, whatever.
Yeah.
And even though I knew we were on separate flights, all of a sudden I look up and I see her walking down the aisle at my different airline even, you know. I'm like, well, what happened, you know? And so
I'm
on the plane.
Oh, my God.
She was able to change her flights from a different airline to the same one I was on so we could go back together and, you know, back to Yale. But anyway, after we went back, we went out a few times and that was it. And now we're...
That was the beginning of the relationship.
That was it. That was 1999. And so 25 years.
So I know that you went to Washington University after this, I think, for your PhD, yeah? But,
yep.
But that's because of the two you got accepted there or something? It was like the two-body problem.
But it's still, before you're looking for jobs, that was residency and graduate school. So, you know, we've kind of been going back and forth on who's got to give in to what's the optimal thing.
Yeah.
She's an absolute rock star, right? So she's in medical school at Yale. She had written, even as an undergrad, she'd written a book on women and violence.
You know? Really?
Yeah, she's like just this ridiculous, you know. She came to the U.S. as for undergrad at Franklin and Marshall. But then just, you know, she's just like that coming to the U.S. to go to school under a full scholarship from Ethiopia. That is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah,
it requires like all the stages that's required to get the type of education to even allow her to do that when you have no money is like ridiculous. So she's completely, you know, insane as academic. So everybody wants her, you know. Me, I'm okay. but we, you know, we kind of, but clearly for my trajectory and for my graduate school, the best place for us to go after lots of learning and understanding and meeting people was certainly WashU. Probably wasn't at the time the best for her because she could have gone anywhere she wanted for residency.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But at the end, we decided to go there. It ended up working out great for her. She met one of her lifelong mentors, Lewis Wall, who does a lot of work, international work and fistula work and women with pelvic birth injuries. Was a great mentor. But it wasn't her top place. She you know, really supportive, and we ended up going there. And so I did grad school there. She finished residency. And then we kind of swapped, you know, sacrifices where we both went to Ethiopia for a year while she was doing a fellowship there in her urogynecology fellowship. And then she matched for her urogynecology fellowship in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
And so then I went and said, let me go find somebody to work with. Yeah.
Can I ask you about Ethiopia?
Sure.
So was that like your first time meaningfully being out of the country?
Let me think. Gosh, was it? Now I travel all over the world, but back then it might have been. To be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it probably was. I mean, I had been in Mexico and Canada and stuff. But no, that was probably it because I didn't travel growing up. And was it.
Well, why would you be suddenly going off to?
So that was probably it. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny to think about it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first time that really happened to me, and I was in my 20s, when I really for the first time left the country, not like Canada or Mexico, as you said, but I really, and I was gone for months and months, and I realized, how do I want to say this? Like, it changed my view of myself as an American. Like, you grow up, I didn't think I was particularly American. You know, I'm just like a person in this country. But when you leave, you're like, oh, you're an American to everybody who meets you. That's the first thing that identify you're an American. By the way you dress, to speak, everything, the things you know. And did you have anything like that?
Oh, no. I had it's a completely different experience, you know, I would say, for me. because I was going to a country where everybody's black.
Yeah.
It was almost the opposite, where I just kind of fit in, you know, and it was like, but that is not normal.
Yeah.
For my normal life.
Yeah.
You know,
and certainly not Minnesota.
Seeing the sea of just this, that was a weird experience for me. And it was fascinating. But on top of that, I also, even though I'm taller, I also have a lot of Ethiopian features. So people oftentimes think I'm Ethiopian.
That's what I mean. But when they talk to you and they realize you're not, and you're going, oh, he's an American. And then you're suddenly put in some other category.
Yeah.
Did you feel any of that?
Not really. Not in that culture. It's just different. You know, huh. I mean, I people were very welcoming. I don't remember that, but it's also very funny because I used to work very closely with her dad, even before I went to Ethiopia, on learning Amharic, you know, the language. Huh. So then I would speak a little bit, and if you speak any Amharic at all to an Ethiopian, they think it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's just so fun, you know? And so anyway, so I guess we probably were in some boxes. I mean, I think they're probably even more for my wife than me, because once they're gone for so long, they become this diaspora, you know,
right,
there's like a,
right,
you know, there's a different feel for the Ethiopians. But I was mostly very welcomed, and it's just it was a great year. I mean, I wrote my dissertation there.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So I was pretty much done with all my experiments. I probably could have graduated, but then, you know, when she got that fellowship, I just asked if I could, you know, spend a year there writing my dissertation and papers, because I was pretty much done, and my committee said that was okay. Mm. So then I went and hung out in coffee shops and worked, yeah, learned the culture and wrote my dissertation.
Okay, so you're at OHSU, and
yep.
What year did you go there for your first year?
My first year there was 2008.
Eight. Okay.
Yep.
I think so. Just tell me where I'm wrong here, but I think you kind of start pushing, or at least, you know, it seems like you're given credit for sort of start pushing for bigger studies that are looking at the brain using fMRI, not necessarily structurally, but for like connections. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I like the Human Connectome Project starts in like 2011.
Yes.
Right.
There was a lot of efforts at that time. But there was kind of a feeling, right, that we needed larger data sets and more time points of data.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we had started, which now is called the Oregon 1000, you know, some initial big projects like that kind of lasted for almost 10 years, me and Joel Nigg. I'm building up some huge data sets. I was working closely with Mike Millam and a few others on building competitions, aggregating data, things of that nature, because we knew that data sharing, stuff like that, it needed to be to get bigger data sets. So we were pushing. I don't think we realized at the time like how important it was, you know, even though we just had a feeling that we needed to do better.
So the Oregon 1000, that's 1,000 people?
Yep.
Adults? Kids, okay.
Yep, yeah. Kids and followed in with ADHD, autism.
Uh-huh, okay. Yep. So I was wondering so that's how you began to turn to autism and ADHD.
Yeah, so when I finished graduate school, we had a lot of papers that really took off, and like some phenomena discovered that we realized, that I realized very early on, that there's a high potential that we could leverage some of these new techniques and technologies and non-invasive imaging to better characterize, understand, and eventually treat mental health disorders. It's funny because so I'm getting back to my clinical, after doing a bunch of basic research, I'm getting back now into my clinical mindset where, you know, I always wanted to do, you know, figure out how this work could be juxtaposed next to, you know, assisting with some various types of clinical phenomena. I didn't necessarily think it was going to be in psychiatry because that was not my thing.
Yeah.
You know, but it became very obvious that these techniques are perfectly set up for these mental health disorders, because studying them with traditional fMRI, which requires tasks and performance and all this kind of stuff, was very hard to do. People were trying, but it's extremely hard to do it well when you have mental health sequelae. But with this new resting state functional connectivity and things of that nature, that kind of wiped out some of those big bottlenecks. And you just could see, like, oh, this could really – maybe there's a path here. So I teamed up with Bonnie Nagel first and then Joel Nigg, who's kind of world-renowned in ADHD research and, in particular, phenotyping kids with mental health disorders. Uh-huh. So what I brought to the table was all this imaging work. What he brought is, like, this phenomenology. Now, a lot of people think I'm an ADHD researcher. I'm not, like, tied to doing work in ADHD. We started there mostly because of convenience and as a model, because it's widespread. There's increasing rates. It's a big deal, but we could test a lot of our ideas, on subtyping and personalizing the what we're looking at in kids, and really kind of testing the waters about what's a better way of characterizing the brain phenomena that correspond to some of these disorders, as opposed to just following like DSM categories and things like that.
Right.
And so that really took off at that time. Yeah.
Is this where, I'm not going to remember the name, but the acronym, I will, FIRM, is this where you started to build the FIRM software or think about that?
Yeah, a little bit. So there's all these events, that occur over time. One of the big events that kicked this off was a discovery that motion-related artifacts and imaging could be clouding what we're seeing and actually making us believe things that we're seeing that's not in the brain that are purely artifacts of motion.
So let's talk about that. That means that, like, if I'm in a scanner or a child is in a scanner and they move their arm or leg, the brain is aware of that, or maybe even initiates that, and that is clouding the scanning.
No, it's a little bit. It's a little bit different. I mean, so yes, if you move your arm or leg, you can see activity in the brain related to that motion, related to that movement. But if you move your head, then it's like trying to take a picture of. Well, it's like trying to take a stationary picture of Usain Bolt, like, flying down the track. It's going to be blurry. There's going to be things, you're going to see a picture of Usain Bolt that's clearly not a precise picture of him because it's blurred, there's artifacts, there's issues with it
because the brain is actually moving.
Because the brain's actually moving.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
So, and that was leading to artifacts in the brain that was making us see things that are not real. So many people had started to work, on ways to deal with the motion issues post data collection.
Right.
And then
by like zeroing things out or trying to find commonalities that you would zero out. Right?
Exactly. By getting rid of, picture frames that have high motion, yeah, or different techniques to kind of filter out the noise. And there's all different types of stuff that over the years that have come of that work. But at the same time, myself and my other close friend and colleague, Nico Dozenbach, were in parallel working on methods to, essentially deal with motion at the source, like why you're collecting it,
Yeah.
How can you deal with motion while you're there? So we teamed up, we got our teams to team up with this idea of like monitoring the motion real time for the people that are running the scanner so they could help adjust provide some feedback to the patients about their own motion, but also adjust your scanning based on just understanding whether there's lots of motion. Because usually you don't know until the patient's gone, they're gone, they're at the house, and you get the data back in your lab, and you realize, yeah, oh my God, this is useless.
Yeah.
So, we said, wouldn't it be great if you just knew in real time the quality of the data? Then if you needed to stay in there for two more minutes or three more minutes to make it a quality scan, you can do that, So we started working, developing a tool for doing all that at the scanner. And the funny thing is, we tried to get that work. We calculated like how much money we would save by just not losing scans.
Yeah.
And it was an enormous amount of money. But when we went to the NIH to try to get it funded, there was no obvious box at the time where this would fit in, no program. Even though it would be saving a lot of money, it was very frustrating. We didn't even apply for a grant. But Nico had been connected and been on some boards with some investors and some VCs, was telling him, was complaining about our inability to do something so obvious. And one of the investors, who's also a friend, said, you know what, we should just turn it into a company.
Yeah.
And we said, sounds good. So we got a little initial investment and then started at that time was called Knaus, and now it's called Turing.
Was it bought?
What's that?
Was it bought? Did Turing buy Knaus?
Or just no. Name? It was just a shift in the name.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. So that's not like, are you, I mean, you're not part of the business, are you? Are you like on the board or anything?
I'm
like
on the board. Yeah. I'm on the board now, but not in a founder.
Yeah.
But I don't do any of the day-to-day operations.
Okay. So tell me how you got back to Minneapolis or back to Minnesota.
Yeah. So, well, first we love Oregon. We love Portland. And I had been being recruited for a long time at different venues to go and start a new center or new, you know, to build up my program to start something new with other places. Yeah. But it was always going to be a heavy lift for us to leave Oregon because we just loved our life. Our kids were connected there.
So you had two kids?
Yep.
You do have two, and they were both born in Oregon?
One was born in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other one was born
okay.
in Oregon.
Okay, so they were growing up in Oregon at that point.
Yep, exactly. And I think there's a couple of things that there were some roadblocks that were happening with my recurring with my wife's international work, you know, with the university. And even though she loved her job, I think she said, you know what, we need to start taking some of these things seriously about potentially moving. And so we went and started taking up some of these offers of going and visiting and checking out places and then actually putting on paper and building up our vision of what we really wanted. And this coincided, in essence, here at the University of Minnesota with this effort where we're at now at MIDB to build out a large center on child brain health that almost mimicked exactly kind of what my vision was of where I wanted to take our work, where I knew and became accustomed to realizing that the only real way for the basic sciences, like the work like mine, to really, really have an impact quickly is if you're connected with all the different pieces and joints and things that are required to make that go. So that means like, it's like clinicians and insurers and commercial and regulatory people and state agencies. There's just like to make things move quickly. I mean, typically it takes like 17 to 20 years for a new discovery to actually get in the hands of a person, you know, or people and policy, education, clinical practice. But the only way really to make it speed up that process, you know, and you don't know this when you start until you try and you realize, oh my God, this is like so complicated. So we had this vision of like pulling different types of teams together to kind of accelerate new discoveries into practice and to learn from our community about what we should be focusing on. And it lined up with the vision of this new entity for this new institute. So, and of course, there was really good opportunities for my wife here as, like I said, the director of Women's Global Health, and to continue on with her, to expand like a lot of her work. And so it just became a really nice fit, and we decided to pull the trigger.
You were able to help develop how this institute looked then?
Absolutely, yeah.
That was the whole point.
Yeah, myself and my co-director, Michael Georgiev. But of course, there's contributors from a bunch of stakeholders, from College of Education and Development, the medical school. There's lots of contributors. I mean, everything from the design of the space that we're in right now to what the clinical practice would look like, to how the research support structures look like, everything's funded, everything, you know, was
But
was
part designed. Of the recruitment for you, it was like, okay, we want to recruit you and we want you to help us figure out how to do this.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And the reason it takes so long for something to go from basic science to discovery, you said whatever, 16, 17 years, is partially that's because academia is so siloed. You're just sort of doing your thing in your lab and then you might publish a paper. But if you're like, if we can bring that all together, you can just, you know, if everyone's aware of what's happening, you can just move much quicker.
Absolutely. And I kind of call it like the baton handoff, you know, most, you know, where, I mean, I've been very fortunate to be around some amazing mentors, have some projects and ideas that worked, which is kind of rare sometimes in our work, that's led to, you know, big papers and, you know, things in The Economist and The New York Times and things like that, you know, which is super exciting and it gets your adrenaline going and it's all. But then you realize what's the next step? You just start over.
Yeah.
and you do it again. And it's like, it's just this cycle. And then, but when you're done, you just, then you just have to wait until somebody can see that discovery and say, oh, I have an idea. I could use it in my clinical practice this way. Or, oh, I wonder if I could tweak my education program by if I knew this thing, you know. And you're just waiting for someone just by chance to see it and like have the vision to be able to think about it, right? Yeah. There's no baton handoff. There's no person you can say, hey, can you now take this to a clinical trial? Or have I designed this the right way that it can be applied in the community, this clinic setting this way?
Yeah.
Or, here's my, my representative. Did you see this result? You know, maybe we should support this bill that for childcare from birth to three, you know? You see what I mean? Like, just sitting there and waiting, and there's not the next step. And oftentimes we're a scientist. We think we're like superpower. We have superpowers where we just can understand everything. Of course we can't. And so we just think in our brains that we can somehow by magic get things to move on to the next stages, but you can't. It's just like you need completely different skill sets and different people who are in have a completely different mindset to kind of grab it and then move it to the next phases.
Huh. So I think you came back here in like 2020.
Yeah.
Right. So I want to ask a couple things. One is, you know, George Floyd is killed in 2020 in this town, right? So when did you move here?
July of 2020.
Yeah. So how was the city then?
Well, it was quiet. It was an interesting time for me because it was a homecoming, so to speak, but everything was, it's right at the start of the,
pandemic,
the start of the middle of the start of the pandemic. And, the movement and the activity that I'm used to in the city was just not there. That I'm bringing my son at the time was just about to start to drive, and my daughter was very young. So coming into my home after the events of George Floyd was very hard, and it required a lot of discussions with my kids and family about like interacting with police and what to do when you're driving and how to act and, things that I probably wouldn't have even done if it wasn't for those events, because you just don't even think about it. But then you're just nervous,
Yeah.
I do remember, it's the impact on our kids was monstrous. I mean, not my kids personally, but just kids in general was monstrous. I mean, I remember my wife and I, my daughter, how old is she? She was probably when I was second grade, maybe. And yeah, second grade. We were driving down to the George Floyd Memorial.
Yeah.
And she was so terrified.
Because there were activists still there, there was protests, or just the concept of going there?
Just the concept of going there, because she wondered whether we should paint our faces white.
Oh my God!
So we wouldn't get hurt by the police, And she's in second grade, so it just it's hard to really imagine how much some of these things impact.
How do you handle that? Because the issue, I mean, it is such a ridiculously complex issue that encompasses all the history of this country. Like how her thinking as well, if my face was different, I wouldn't be in any trouble here.
Yes.
Like, how did you explain?
It was a history lesson, a remembrance, it was a very positive experience overall, for us to be there and to see it and to be part of it.
Yeah.
There were still some marches and whatnot going on, organizers, and all that was very positive for my kids to see, the importance of community organizing and working towards advocacy to what you believe.
Yeah.
I think that's all very positive. And so, of course, we it's mostly just comfort and say, oh, it's okay. And then have some experiences where things end up being okay. And
positive.
Then
you, right.
And it's all right. But it just goes to show you like the impact that all these events around us are occurring. There's actually other positive, funny stories that are similar with my kids in the same vein, which is almost the complete opposite. Like when my son was just like, man, so it's like 4 years old. This is when we first moved to Portland. He's in preschool with one of his good buddies who's now still a really close friend, who's white. And his parents came up to me, we were just meeting them, but now their family's really close to us, came up to us and said, you know, my son, you know, we're so happy they met. He wants to be, you know, black like Amos. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means, but it's like, okay, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm introducing him, his parents to my wife, and I said, oh, he wants to be African and wants to be black like Amos, their son. It's, you know, I'm kind of laughing. I was like, no. I didn't say he wants to be black like Amos or African-American like Amos. He said he wants to be American like Amos. You misheard me. I said he wants to be American like Amos. And I was like, really? I said, well, what? I said, what is, like, why does your son think that Amos is more American than him?
Yeah. Was he not born in the country?
He was born in the country, yeah. And it turns out it's 2008. Barack Obama was just made president.
Uh-huh.
And there's some believe that the only way you could be American is if you looked like the president.
Huh.
So it just goes to show you like the developing brain, like how they're influenced by all these events around you is monstrous. I mean, of course, Barack Obama was our first black president, ever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So you just go back and like imagine, like, man, it's like everybody. How long this? Like, think about what's happening inside these kids' heads. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it has a huge influence on who they are. So.
Wow. Okay. So, right. So I actually want to. I read. You were giving an interview someplace, and you said this super fascinating thing, which I wanted to ask you about, and it was that when we're born, we have all the neurons in our brain already. And by two, all the connections are mostly formed, right? So if you think about that, and it's like the human brain is basically just shaped from that point on.
Like I call it, it's more like building a sculpture out of a formed rock than it is like building a house from the foundation up.
Right.
So you're like chipping away at the rocks to make like this beautiful, you know, sculpture, essentially.
Unique brain that you have, right.
And that's one of the reasons why you're so plastic, and we have such high plasticity and stuff in the early ages, but other things as well. But that process is definitely, you know, how we, in the experiences that we have is how we grow and mature, for sure.
But it's just through having experiences over and over, storing them away, linking them up. That's it. I'm not saying that that's not nothing. That's amazing.
Yes.
But, I mean, I was shocked at the brain at two being fully formed. And then by mass, by five. I mean, I think I probably would have thought that, but I didn't ever do the math
It's about at five or six, it's about 95% of the adults. That's why they have these, you know, these bobblehead kids walking all around because they have these big heads and little bodies.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's absolutely right. That's exactly how we develop.
Yeah, I mean, you don't seem, maybe it's because this is new news to me, but I'm fascinated by that.
Well, I tell you, here's I think the important thing for folks to conceptualize, right, is that what that means is that the initial rock, the initial formation of all the neurons, all the connections, all the stuff that you're going to have for the rest of your life that you're kind of whittling away at, you know, throughout aging and senescence and everything, right? It's incredibly important to get that initial setup right. And what that means is that all the neurons are born and they migrate to their place, the interactions with inflammatory response, all the synapses are there, the tracks are formed, all that stuff is happening when you're in utero and up through, you know, essentially the first year of life or so. It just tells you like, oh my gosh, that period of development is incredibly, incredibly important. And so things around nutrition and stress and environmental exposures and all that kind of stuff, you know, that we talk about is incredibly important for the developing brain to get us started on the right foot, you know.
Okay, I think there's two things that I want to ask you about. One is, so I was at SFN this year.
Yeah.
And I sat in on your lecture, your presidential
lecture. Okay, yeah.
Super interesting. All of it was super interesting. A lot of it was like things we've talked about, sort of the history of fMRI or scanning the brain. But the thing that was probably most compelling is the videos that you're showing at the end.
Yeah.
So you showed a man named Mike who is treatment-resistant depressive for a long time.
Yeah.
And you'd done this targeted cortical stimulation in his brain.
Yes.
And there's also some of that you were showing for chronic pain, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I know that you looked at his like his salience network or something to try to figure out, but I could not really figure out how you were able to figure out where to put the paddles.
Oh, right.
Yes. I mean, I know it's not going to be trial and error. You're not going to put them in, sew them up, but how's that? And I'm sure you looked at like a billion scans, but how did you figure out where to first? Because I think the videos that we saw were the first, that was the first location, the only location for Mike.
No, there's several locations that we were stimulating with Mike. And I think I showed, I did show different behavioral swakala. I was showing the responses during the testing where we're done from different spots in the brain.
So you were turning them on and off. Okay.
That's right.
I got it. Okay. So how did you figure out where to put those various paddles?
Well, you know, that comes from the mapping. So we, you know, it's funny. It's been, 20 years we've been at this working on, it's amazing that it's been that long, but working on really refining the abilities to identify and characterize networks in our brain. Again, I've been doing that very closely with my friend and colleague, Nico Dosenbach, who's one of the hottest cognitive neuroscientists right now in this space. But the discovery that, you know, but the reality is to be able to do that within a given person, we've kind of struggled it for a while.
So I think the question is, and I should have maybe said this a little better, but yes, it's the mapping, but how did you know based on his description of his phenotype that it aligns up so well with the map?
Well, number one is when we have the techniques, kind of data collected, processing, everything to get the fingerprint of the brain of every individual. We can do that now.
Yeah.
And when we first looked at his brain, it's fascinating what happens when you have really, really good signal in a picture, because there's no statistics, there's no fancy math. We can literally just look at the brain, look at the network and say, that's wrong. You know, you can see the pathology in his brain just by looking at it with your own eyes. And it's almost like, in my previous clinical days when I was doing stroke, it wasn't very hard to see if someone had a stroke. You just like look at the scan and there it is and you can see it.
Huh.
But the pathology that you can see in these, with this new technique in these participants and some of these patients that have really severe depression, it's almost like that where you can literally just see it. You can say, oh, this particular system, it's called the salience network, was very enlarged. It was kind of encroaching on these other networks that we 20 years ago have been identifying, trying to understand and identify the function for that long. Those functions, those networks map onto the specific types of symptoms and phenotype of major depression. So you're like, oh, well, but they're very personalized. So we said, okay. And then on top of that, so there's one other nugget here, which maybe hopefully is not too complicated for the audience, but is Ziad Nahas, who's actually the PI of this study, in 2010 published a paper that did a similar type of technique of neuromodulation, but without the map, you know, where they just put the neuromodulators just like, you know, blindly in this coordinate space that we thought was in general a place to go for this. And to the credit of that study, you know, 3 of 5 patients did well. And, you know, so we have all this information, we pull all this information, you know, the history of 20 history of understanding the function of these, identifying these systems and understanding their function, 15-year history of like previously doing neuromodulation in the brain, but without that that information. And now we can map these systems in every single person so well that you can see the pathology with your eyes. Mm. Then it's just working with the neurosurgeon and planning to place those electrodes right on the right spots. We have a very good surgeon. His name is David Darrow, who he's like, you know, really precise. And then I remember getting, I was driving and I got a call from Ziad as they started doing some of the testing. And he said, you'd never believe it, you know, that this patient Mike is crying in tears of joy when we stimulate part of the brain we thought would do that.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that was one of the videos you showed.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like, we got it. We kind of understand. And of course, 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, one of our colleagues, and this is all why this is going on, Chuck Lynch and Connor Liston at Cornell, they just published this paper in Nature, which validated everything that we did. But they didn't do any treatment, but they were just showing that the same thing that we're seeing, you know, in our patients and what we, in the phenomenology of like the outcomes, they can see in other patients too. So we feel like we got it. We're pretty confident, and we're pushing forward with really, you know,
so
with the baton handoff, you know, with the clinical trials and trying to get this stuff out there.
So was Mike in a trial?
He is. He's in a small trial that's FDA approved and all that.
How many other people were in that?
Well, he's the first, and there's others that are on the list. Yeah.
I see. Okay, so I'm going to ask this question, and I hope it sounds like the compliment that it is, like, because that is such groundbreaking work, right? Obviously groundbreaking work. But sometimes I also think, like, in 50 years when we look back, it'll be like, God, that was so crude.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's like you can see how, as you said, 15 years of this and 15 years of mapping the brain, you get to this point. When you add another 40 years on top of that, it's going to be...
Oh, yeah, and it's happening. This, I would say 40, I'd say like 10, you know, because essentially... there's all these different sectors that have coalesced to allow a new way of therapeutics that's around modulating the brain.
Yeah.
And that includes, like, you know, there's computing, AI, clouds, you know, things like that. The math, the neuroscience that I've been just talking about have finally caught up with, like, the engineering and the devices. And not only that, but like the now commercial and investments and governments are – so like all this stuff is like kind of coming together. And I can't even tell you how many technologies are out there now of different ways that you can modulate the brain both invasively and non-invasively through like focus ultrasound and magnets and direct stimulation of things on the scalp and things underneath the scalp. And there's this plethora of things that are coming out that are ways to kind of modulate the brain in new ways. And the only thing that what in 10 years, like which ones of these technologies will have won, which have become the most useful is not, I don't think anybody really knows. The only thing that we know for sure is that they're all going to need to know where to go. They need the GPS of the brain, and that's what these maps really are.
Okay, so you're saying, like, that's the most important part is figuring out exactly where to put it in the brain.
Yep.
Whether or not it's, you know, just under the skin, on the skin, or actually in the brain, we're not sure yet. We're not going to know that for a certain amount, 10 years, as you said.
Yeah, there's current technologies we can use today, and that's what will be used today. To your, you know, 40 years from now, we'll look back and probably say that was crude.
Yeah.
But we'll have saved lots of patients.
Yeah.
But the next generation, which would probably be a lot more simple, you know, who knows, things that you can do at home. I don't know. There's a million ideas. There's lots of companies. There's a lot of institutions are investing in this. Here at the University of Minnesota, we have an entire, it's almost like an industry complex, the support from the state and a lot of effort and support from the university to drive new neuromodulation technologies. And so, like, you know, you just look around, you can see it happening. There's a ton of experts here that are just really driving the field. And, you know, the future is bright in this space, and it's a complement to other ways that we typically try to treat disorders with drugs and medicines and sometimes with behavioral therapy, but being able to essentially, it's almost like playing keys on a keyboard. In fact, one of the videos I showed you at SFN.
Yeah.
Was of where patient Mike was actually taking orders. He's like, I want a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing, right? So the future is here. It's just now so I'm very excited about even the near-term future in this space for sure.
And so he'd been, that's like 20 months he'd been with these implants?
21 months.
21 months.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Oh,
thank you.
Okay.
Well, the discussion around brain stimulation therapy was truly invigorating. I felt like I was seeing into the future about what might be possible when brain mapping meets the clinic. But the bit I think I'll always remember is Damien talking about driving his children down to see the George Floyd Memorial in Minneapolis. That was the thing that kept popping up in my mind on my flight home. So thank you, Damien, for allowing me to bring equipment into the Institute and for a great talk. Okay, this podcast will be archived on thetransmitter.org, where we have also included a transcript. In the transcript, we've inserted links to some of the people discussed, so check that out if you'd like more information. This show can be found wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or in whatever podcast app that you use. Some of the information for our intro came from the website for Yale New Haven Hospital. If you'd like to comment on this show or whatever we do with The Transmitter, you can find us on the social media platforms X, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and LinkedIn. Our theme song was written and performed by Chris Collinwood. Thank you for listening to Synaptic.
How does it work? Like,
we take a couple like original photos, and then we just give them to this artist who does all of them.